Welcome to Before They Were Live, an ongoing monthly and extremely nerdy conversation through the land of fairy or the perilous realm. In his seminal essay on fairy stories, J.R.R. Tolkien says he has hardly been more than a wandering explorer or trespasser in the land, full of wonder but not of information. We take the same tack. We are, as ever, interested in playing our part in a healthy ecosystem of art and criticism and fandom, paying attention to the way stories have shaped our collective imaginations. We are slurpers of soup, happy to ladle out a bowl full from the great cauldron of story that has been bubbling and brewing for centuries. W.H. Auden said, art is our chief means of breaking bread with the dead. So pull up a chair to our table, grab yourself a soup bowl, a big old chunk of homemade bread, help us enrich the reading experience, and have some fun too. This is our fourth foray into the world of the Arabian Nights. Even though we've been doing this show for many years, we've discussed a lot of movies, a lot of shorts, some fairy tales. We've never tried to discuss something of this length. The story today is the story of King Umar ibn al-Nu'man and his sons Sharkan and Dhow al-Makan, and the strange and remarkable things that happened to them. And we actually aren't even covering the entire tale, only the first 170 or so pages of it. This is nights 45 through 106 for those who are keeping score at home. Helping me, as always, is a poet, an essayist, and most important, a human being who can regularly be found loudly reciting poetry in the middle of the night and upsetting the peace of his neighbors. When they beg him to stop, he only replies, "Who can stop me reciting poetry? I shall do it whatever happens to me, for I am near my own land and I don't care about anyone. I must recite." It's Michael Farmer.
That's hey, Michael. Me. How you doing, Josh?
It sounds like you. I've not actually witnessed that, but you know, I thought it sounds accurate.
I wish I could recite poetry. I don't have any of it memorized.
Oh man. So, I am not a great memorizer of things, and I was actually ashamed this week. We had what we call spring trips with our students, and so on the bus, I was trying to get some reading done in this book. I was very unsuccessful, but the kids were asking me about it, and I was able to tell them a very sixth grade friendly version of the framing story, which is difficult in itself. And then they asked if I could tell them any of the stories that she has been telling to save her life. And I just was completely blank. I was like, no, I cannot. Not because of the content of them, but just like, I was like, I'm ashamed. I should be a better storyteller than this. But I didn't have anything to recite to them. So
they're so enormous.
If my life was on the line, I would be dead. Yeah, but she tells them every night, and I couldn't even do it on the bus.
Are Chinese students not familiar with the story of Scheherazade?
So I don't know how much a sixth grader of any culture necessarily is like familiar with them. And my students are not all Chinese, so they are I have a mix. And I was talking to some Korean boys and a Venezuelan. And when I said the Arabian Nights, one asked me if that was Aladdin, and I just told him Aladdin wasn't in this particular version. But yeah, that's like related enough. But the rest of them were not familiar with it. No.
Interesting. Yeah, I feel like when I was a kid, they had told us that Scheherazade existed, but also, you know, we were 10 years old when Aladdin came out. So.
Yeah.
But I remember there's the line in Aladdin, Scheherazade. I've already forgotten. Like we said, not good at memorization. Scheherazade. there's a line about Scheherazade in Friend Like Me in Aladdin, and I don't remember that line being confusing to me. So I must have known the story of Scheherazade. Again, a grade school appropriate one, because the real story, as we discovered last year, is kind of spicy.
A little spicy, yes, that's a good way to put it.
This one is basically a novel. It's more than 300 pages long. By the time we get to it, we will have read, I think, twice as much as we had read in the previous three episodes. It's not a story in any meaningful way. It's a novel, although it does hold together. I was worried that with something this long in the kind of folktale fairy tale genre, you would get a lot of a lot of detours that don't go anywhere, a lot of rabbit trails. That's something we noticed a lot in Grimm's Fairy Tales. But actually, this is written more or less like a novel, where there are all these pieces and they kind of go apart and then come back together. There is not a lot of extraneous material here. And that is going to make it difficult to summarize in any kind of short way. Also, there's the issue that we're dealing with 61 nights or 62 nights in this episode. And there are not – the reason we stopped where we stopped is because night 107 has a new story that's entering. But that means there are no divisions here. So we had to kind of artificially create divisions so that we're not just summarizing the entire thing and then trying to cover the entire thing. So I did what anybody would do in 2026, which is I asked ChatGPT to give us divisions. And so it gave us 45 to 49, 50 to 57, 58 through 67, 68 through 79, 80 through 86, 87 through 93, 94 through 100, and 101 to 106. And those divisions are mostly as good as anybody could do, I think, although it does interrupt a particular like philosophical disquisition at one point. So we'll actually start that and then go back and talk and then come back and finish it. But, you know, whatever. You're going to do it the way you're going to do it. So I stayed up late last night writing summaries of all of these sections. So instead of going back and forth like we usually do, I'm just going to summarize all of them. So let's start with 45 to 49.
Okay, before...
yeah, go ahead, please.
Sorry, Michael, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, please,
I just want to ask you a quick question on the novel aspect, because I think you probably know more of your literary history than I do. So this does predate what we would consider novels, though, right?
It depends on what you would call a novel. So, I mean, the traditional first novel is Cervantes's Don Quixote, but the truth is there's long prose fiction before that. Most notably in ancient Rome, there's a book called the Satyricon that's basically a novel. So yes and no. I'm a little suspicious of Don Quixote being quote unquote the first novel, especially, I mean, there's really no sense other than it being part of this much larger collection. There's really no sense in which Umar ibn al-Nu'man and his family is not a novel, right? It is a long piece of prose fiction with lots and lots of characters and lots of subplots that nevertheless, at least so far, forms a cohesive whole.
Yeah, which is what I felt too. So I was wondering where the difference, or if this is like a contender for earliest novel, you know, like I didn't know, like, you know, it seems like there's always, you know, a little bit of jostling in any academic world where it's like, oh no, this is actually the first one. So yeah. I didn't know if this was a contender or not.
Especially if you're dealing with something where the definition is a little bit difficult to pin down. I mean, what counts as a novel? I mean, isn't there a sense in which the deuterocanonical book of Judith, for example, or Tobit's probably a better example. Tobit's a novel, basically, or a novella. But very few people ever call it a novel. But it's not exactly book length, but it's a longish piece of prose fiction. I mean, I know you won't have a problem me calling the Book of Tobit fiction, but I think most Catholics agree that it's fiction. And Judith too, which is another deuterocanonical book.
Yeah.
Tobit is actually, maybe we should look at that sometime after we finish 1001 Nights, or at least this first third of it. God knows when that will be, but it might be worthwhile doing a kind of palate cleanser with the Book of Tobit, because we could easily do it in one episode. And it is kind of a fairy tale. You've got some kind of standard fairy tale elements to it. It might be worth doing a kind of mini, not even mini series, just a one-off episode. What Dan Carlin calls a blitz.
Yeah. Yeah, that could be really fun. Yeah. Yeah, when we got to night 100, I was like, all right, we're 10% through.
Yeah, that's well, we're not doing the entire, we're doing volume one in this Penguin edition, but even that is 1,000 pages.
I know. Yeah.
Oof. What have you gotten us into, Josh? I did not assume this. I should have. I don't know why I did not think that this was literally 1,001 nights. I thought, oh, it's probably like 150 nights. I mean, it's good. There's lots of stuff that I'm glad I've read. It's really a very beautiful and strange book, but ooh, boy, is it long.
Yeah, it is very long. So anyway, I didn't mean to rabbit trail us too bad there.
So. No, that's okay. So let's look at 45 to 49. Umar ibn al-Numan is a king who rules this vast empire. He's stationed in Baghdad, which a lot of these stories are because it was the center of the Abbasid Caliphate. Umar's son, Sharkan is famous for his military skill. And he is set to inherit his father's throne, but unbeknownst to him, one of Umar's concubines gives birth to twins. Now, I have to talk about the concubine before I talk about the twins. She is actually, her name is Sophia, and she's the daughter of Afridun, who is the emperor of Byzantium. And she gives birth to twins. One of them is a boy named Daw al-Makan, and one of them is a girl named Nuzhat al-Zaman. And as they grow up, because they kind of leave the story for a few nights. But as they grow up, Sharkan leads a military expedition it's hard to tell because Byzantium is at war with another Christian power, and it seems like the Muslims are kind of semi-joining the Byzantine Empire and semi-fighting against them. They're not exactly allies. But anyway, in the course of this military expedition, he comes across a convent and he watches these beautiful young women wrestling each other naked, which weird behavior at a convent. One of them turns out to be this extraordinarily beautiful young woman named Abraza, and all the Christians have Muslim names. And she eventually challenges him to a contest and defeats him in a wrestling match, much to his shame. And they spend all night drinking and reciting poetry and playing chess. And she's better than him at all of these things. And it makes him fall in love with her. The next morning, a Byzantine army arrives to capture Sharkan because it turns out that Abraza is also a Byzantine princess. And in night 49, she tells the soldiers that Sharkan is her guest. And that is the end of that section. I don't know where you expected it to go, but I did not have naked wrestling at the convent in mind.
That wasn't on your bingo card?
Well, and I left something out, which is that one of the she actually ends up being important. One of the people that Abraza wrestles is this old woman who farts while they're wrestling. Yeah. There's actually a lot of scatology in this little novel, so keep that in mind.
Yeah, there's a lot of that sort of level of humor.
There's a lot of everything. There's 25 pages of what amounts to a medieval philosophical disquisition about the nature of kingship, and there's also an old lady farting.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And some of that that philosophical treaty is given by that same old lady. You know?
Yeah, that's so, right.
Not to spoil anything that's coming up, but. Yeah, it's a very weird. So this section, it felt a little like, you know, kind of the classic, like the knight errant, rides off on his own away from the army and falls into this like mystical or fairy, you know, land of peril, the perilous realm, like, you know, beautiful women, and it's like peaceful and, you know, just. A paradise basically that he like finds himself in. And there's even like a bit of enchantment that seems to be happening with him because he knows he should be getting back to his army, but he cannot resist like the allure of this princess and all of her many talents. It's very interesting. And then it's got that, I don't know, that classic kind of Amazonian warrior princess, like you know, like the women warriors that are actually better than the male warriors, Artemis is hunters, you know, like all that, you know, that kind of thematic imagery as well.
Yeah, that's right. It in its way, like, this feels more medieval than a lot of the stories we've been looking at. A lot of them feel curiously modern to me. But this one really does feel like, as you say, like a knight errant quest. It reminds me a little bit, not so much in terms of the plot, but in terms of the feeling of this section. It reminds me a little bit of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Have you read that?
Yes, yeah.
That would be another, that would be another one.
That would be fun to do.
Yeah.
Keep adding to the list.
Yeah, that's right. We actually have a literal list somewhere of like 58 texts or whatever. Who knows if we'll get
it. I think I actually added Sir Gawain to it the other day.
Oh,
like,
great.
I think a week ago I added Sir Gawain to it. So.
Great, yes. Anyway. Sir Gawain has a lot of fairy tale elements, as does this. What interested me about this is how little whoever wrote this story understands Christian spirituality. The idea that this, and this is kind of a running theme throughout, is you have this Muslim attempt to understand Christianity without really understanding the basics. And the thing you see later is that they believe that Christians are polytheists, which is a Muslim complaint about Christianity to this day. But also, apparently they think that convents are a place where beautiful women go to drink wine and do kind of semi-sexual stuff, which I guess there are probably convents that get kind of decadent, but there's no sense in which these women are supposed to be pious women, really. It's a weird misunderstanding of this thing that's very foreign to whoever's writing this.
Yeah, it's kind of a cross between like a harem.
Yeah, exactly right. It feels more like a harem.
And the king in this case is like Jesus, I guess, you know? I mean, they don't go there, but like, you know, like just trying to piece together like what's going on. And then also like, I don't know, like I don't really think of like, and maybe I'm just ignorant here, but I don't generally think of like Christian monks and definitely not nuns as like having a martial art.
Right.
You do kind of get that sort of like Shaolin feel with like the more like, you know, Eastern, monks and stuff. So it's like a weird blend of those two things, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, what you would call it if it was a Westerner writing about the East, you would call it Orientalism, right? That it's just kind of defining the Christians by not being Muslim. Like the things Muslims are supposed to do, these Christians don't do. I guess you could call it Occidentalism. And, you know, again, this is a very medieval thing. When you look at Christian writings about Muslims from the same period, they misunderstand Islam every bit. The one I'm thinking of, there's a French epic poem called The Song of Roland, the Chanson de Roland. And it suggests that Muslims worship Muhammad and the god Apollo, which, if you're keeping track, Muslims don't worship either of those people. So, this is not exactly a criticism of the Thousand and One Nights. It's that this is just what it's like in the Middle Ages when one group talks about the other group. There's a kind of funny misunderstanding of what exactly is going on.
Yeah, that's a really helpful putting this in context, because it is striking, particularly as a Christian reading it, like. Because, you know, the Christians are definitely the bad guys. And I think the piety piece in particular, it's like from the Muslim, at least, you know, reading it as a, 21st century Christian, like, obviously I'm like having to like work through several layers to like put myself back into like what the author was thinking. But it definitely, it seems like there's a feeling of like Christians can't actually be pious because they don't have, like there's no true worship, right? So whatever they're doing, it's like not, it's never really piety in the way that the Muslim, like, because the Muslims can be, you can be a pious or a not pious Muslim. Like that's part of the whole philosophical treaty that we're gonna get to later, right? Like there's a way to be a pious Muslim, but it doesn't seem like there's actually a way to be a pious Christian. It seems like there's only, I don't know, decadence, I guess is the word you used, right?
Which is something a little bit different from the other presentations of Christians in the Thousand and One Nights, at least the ones we've seen so far. Like there are other stories that we've read that are substantially more sympathetic to Christians and Jews than this one is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this one we'll get to it in the next section. There's a moment where it feels like it's sympathetic, but I think that I think it's doing something else besides sympathy, but when we get to that section, I'll talk about it.
Well, the author certainly likes Abraza, right? I mean, she's an appealing character. She's not a hypocrite. There's a lot of respect for her. But that's kind of separate mm-hmm. from her being Christian.
Yeah.
Well, let's look at the next section. This is 50 through 57. So Sharkon leaves the convent and he comes across his army. And they've become very distressed during his absence. And so he orders them to go back to Baghdad. But on the way, they find their way blocked by a Christian army. And it turns out it's led by Abrazah herself, although they don't know that at first. She turns out to be this incredible warrior, unsurprising since she was so good at wrestling. She even knocks Sharkon off his horse. But then, once she does that, she formally renounces her family and her homeland and says that she'll go back with him to Baghdad. Presumably, she's fallen in love with him just as he's fallen in love with her. So they get to Baghdad, and they tell King Umar their story, and he welcomes Abrazah into his court. And then, and this will be important later on, there are actually very few details in this that are not important. Then Umar gives Sharkon a jewel, and he tells him that he gave two similar jewels to his brother and his sister, Daw al-Makan and Nuzhat al-Zaman, these two twins who have been born. But this is the first Sharkon has ever heard of his brother. He knew he had a sister, but he didn't know he had a brother. They kept it a secret from him because he was already concerned that he wouldn't succeed his father. And so when he finds out about Daw al-Makan, he immediately goes mad with jealousy because he's worried about his inheritance. But Abrazah very wisely tells him he needs to trust his father and he needs to be patient. And so Sharkon gives her his jewel. But she was wrong to say that he should trust his father because actually King Umar falls desperately in love with Abrazah. And when she refuses his advances, he drugs and rapes her. And so she is pregnant. She's ashamed and she's furious. And so she leaves Baghdad with a maid and a slave giving birth in the desert on the way back to her convent. The slave demands to sleep with her. And when she refuses, he kills her. And her father, King Hardub, he arrives too late to rescue her. And so he swears revenge on the Muslims for allowing this to happen. And he takes Abrazah's son and raises him as his own. And I assume that's going to pay off in the second half of the novel, but it hasn't paid off yet. Meanwhile, Umar sees that Sharkon is jealous of his younger half-brother, and so he makes him governor of Damascus, which is, other than Baghdad, the most powerful city in this empire. And so Daw al-Makan and Nuzhat al-Zaman grow up with Sharkon very far away from them. And they become adults, and they want to go on a pilgrimage to Mecca, which pious Muslims are supposed to do at least once in their life. And Umar will not allow this pilgrimage. In fairy tale fashion, they sneak out and they go anyway. But on the way, they get separated from their caravan. And while they're in Jerusalem, Daw falls terribly ill. And Nuzhat, unable to reveal who she is, runs out of resources taking care of him. And when she tries to become a servant to make enough money to heal him, she's kidnapped by a Bedouin who plans to sell her into slavery. And she ends up being bought by a merchant because the merchant recognizes that she's not just a regular slave, that she's some sort of important person. And it's his motivations are difficult to parse out. Either he wants to take care of her because he feels bad for her, or he figures he can get a pretty good reward by taking care of her. Meanwhile, Daw is rescued by a furnace man, I assume. I don't know if that's a guy who spends all day stoking a furnace or what. But this furnace man spends an outrageous amount of money to take care of him. And he even helps him live in a certain luxury. He actually goes without so that Daw al-Makan can get sherbet. Well, when Daw recovers from his illness, he convinces the furnace man to accompany him to Damascus. And the furnace man's wife dies, which is actually a detail that's not terribly important. And Daw is in this incredible grief because he's been separated from his twin sister. And that is where Night 57 ends. A little bit more action than that first one.
Yeah, quite a bit. Quite a bit of almost like sudden action. So the moment I was going to talk about, like, let's keep talking about the princess. She doesn't last very long in this section, which was terrible, really, really surprising.
Yeah, me too. And I was bummed out.
Just killed her off.
I was bummed out because I really liked her character.
And because, as you just said, it seems like there's some level of respect for her. And so when she first shows up with her, they're called a Frankish army. I guess they're dressed like Frenchmen or something.
No,
and
they're called Frankish because that is what the Crusader side was called during the Crusades. So, you know, that's why they're called Franks.
Okay. So that helps me with my mental image a little bit.
It means they're Christians who are coming from Western Europe as opposed to Constantinople.
Sure. Yeah. So anyway, the language when the armies first meet is actually it's almost word for word repeated of the way that they describe Sharkin when he's fighting, because he has to actually kind of fight his way out of the combat. And so I was like, oh, this seems like some sort of like respect for your enemies, like that they would describe the enemy Christian warriors in the same way that they were describing this like hero of our tale, you know. But then it turns out that they're not actually who they thought they were, but it's still the princess, right? So still not nominally a Christian. So there does seem to be some, I don't know, respect of the enemies, but I feel like this is the last moment that we see it in here. And it very quickly like goes away because she dies. I mean, what happens to her after leaving home is like tragic and like nauseating. Like, I mean, it's a very, very bad end for what seemed like a really promising and interesting and admirable character.
Yeah, she goes from being this woman warrior to just a pure victim. Right. It's disappointing, not just on a narrative level, but on a characterization level, that this woman who is so powerful, as soon as she gets to Baghdad, is helpless.
Yeah. And it's distressing. And so I don't know if there's, I don't know I don't, what messages are meant to be in the novel, if it's just pure entertainment or if there are messages or, you know, like, I don't know. I'm just trying to make sense of it as a reader, you know. I was like, is it because she left her like country? Is that so much like, you know, that is true even in our world, right? Like you can have a doctorate in a country and then you're an immigrant and, you know, in this new place, like it doesn't matter. Like if you're, you know, if your credentials don't match up, you know, then you can be working as a, you know, a janitor or whatever, you know, it doesn't like, so there is a sense that like outside of your own home area, you are without any sort of power or ability to help yourself, which is the same thing that we see with the princes and the princess, right? Like they're stuck in Jerusalem,
right?
And you know, even though their dad is the king, like they're completely helpless. So it does seem like there's some thematic element of like, I don't know, don't leave home.
That goes all the way back to the dawn of civilization. I mean, one of the big Greek myths is Jason and Medea. And Medea is this very powerful sorceress who betrays her family, kills her family to help Jason find the golden fleece. And when they go back to, I think it's Corinth, when they go back to Corinth, he abandons her for another woman. And she's not exactly helpless because she takes her revenge in a kind of horrible fashion. But there is the sense that she just does not have a way to stop him from doing this. Whereas she has an enormous amount of power where she comes from on the Black Sea. When she gets back to Greece, she's kind of nothing. And the same thing happens mm-hmm. here. Foreigners are helpless. That's one reason why hospitality is so important. Think about the difference between the way she treats him in the convent and the way his father treats her in Baghdad.
Yeah, which is another interesting thing because, yeah, definitely. Not painting him in the best light, that's for sure.
I don't get the sense that the novel really judges King Umar for this. He continues to be presented as a good man moving forward, even though what he's done here from our perspective at least is just awful.
It's hard to tell again because, you know, all the main criticisms against him are always in the mouths of the enemy. So is the author agreeing with those thoughts when they're coming from the mouths of the enemy, or is it saying like, you know, these are in the mouths of the enemy, so they're not to be trusted, they're not to be believed,
right? With Da'al Makan and Nuzhat al-Zaman, you get kind of a Hansel and Gretel type story where you have these, they're not children. They're adults by this point, but they're very young adults. The implication is they've never left.
I think they're just like, yeah, they're like 14, 15.
You think they're that
like,
young?
I think he's like 14 when, I think it said that, like when, cause he wants to go on the pilgrimage at 14 and, then his dad asked, like, wants him to wait another year.
Gotcha. So I missed a little older
to go. By the time they return, like, it's 5 years that they're gone. So by the time they get back, which we'll get to, you know, late, and I think one of the final sections, he's closer to actual adult. I think if I did the math right.
Well, and 14,
the timeline in the story is very hard to follow.
And 14 in the 14th century is not the same thing as 14 now.
Right. Yeah, that's very true.
But anyway, you get this kind of Hansel and Gretel setup where they're lost in the woods, basically. Hansel and Gretel don't get separated, but they do. They are kind of all each other has. And you get that sense until the separation. And then you have another pretty standard fairy tale trope, which is that this princess who falls from grace ends up still being a princess deep down, and somebody with eyes to see is capable of seeing that. This Bedouin can't tell, right? All this Bedouin knows is that she's beautiful, but the merchant sees something in her that's real that the Bedouin is not capable of seeing. The Bedouin doesn't realize the opportunity he's missed because he just sees her as a body, basically.
Yeah.
And then you have kind of the parable of the Good Samaritan with the furnace man who comes in and spends everything he has to take care of Da'al Makan. And there, did you get the sense that he had any idea who Da'al Makan was? To me, it was just like, he thinks he's a penniless beggar and he takes care of him just out of pure charity.
Yeah. He does see something in him. You know, it says like when he first sees him, he thinks he's dead, and he's like, "Why'd they throw this, you know, this corpse on my pile of rubbish here?" You know, but then he realizes he's alive, and he does see, like, you know, the it's always the beauty of the moon or whatever, you know, is always in the story. In it, so he sees something in him. But you're right, like there's not like a deep understanding of like, oh, this guy's worth a kingdom, you know, which is like with the merchant. Says about his sister. So
right, and importantly, Nuzhat does not tell the merchant her real name. That's going to be an important plot point in the next section. So he has a sense that she's an important person, but he does not know she's a princess, and he does not know in particular that she is the daughter of King Umar, the emperor who rules this entire realm.
Yeah.
Well, are you ready for the next section?
Yeah, the only other thing I was going to say in here, just because it's interesting to me, like when there's like these touch points from like, I mean, we're talking across culture and across, you know, 1,000 years, like the thing that the furnace man's wife does to help Dal al-Makan get better is she feeds him chicken. It's like, oh, it's universal.
Trust the folkways.
Yep, trust the folkways, that's right.
So 58 through 67, my summary here is very short because about half of this section is a discourse. But so this merchant takes Nuzhat al-Zaman to the governor of Damascus, who listeners will remember is Sharkan, her half-brother, although they don't know that. Nevertheless, Sharkan is really impressed with her because she's so educated and she's so obviously good and beautiful. And so he marries her. And he rewards the merchant with permanent tax-exempt status. So the merchant gets the reward he was hoping for. And then there is a lengthy discourse at the wedding, I believe, where Nuzhat talks about the duties of a pious king. And we can talk about as much of that as you want to. On their wedding night, they consummate the marriage. And in fairy tale fashion, Nuzhat is immediately pregnant with her half-brother's baby, although neither of them still realize that he is her half-brother. So, like I said, about half this section is that discourse, which I don't know how much you want to talk about it.
Yeah, I it's really enjoyable that it's in here. I think It's one of those things where like it really gives you some insight into, the thoughts of the time. I mean, it's like a series of proverbs almost, just the way that she talks about these things. There's also a lot that I feel like I'm missing, where I'm, especially when she brings up certain people, like I don't know who this person is, but yeah, it's I definitely underlined a few things in here just as far as, whoever abandons moderation finds his intellect going astray. Like that's a pretty yeah, that's a good proverb,
You can see the
So
influence
there's definitely a lot in here.
of Aristotle there on Muslim philosophy of this period. It is the Muslims who rediscover Aristotle and send him to the West. And like that's Aristotle's big ethical principle, the golden mean, that moderation is the kind of key to understanding goodness and evil. She also preaches a theme that's going to come up a little bit later, which is detachment. So the idea is you have to detach yourself from this world to one degree or another because you're going to die one day and be judged for what you did in this life. So the best tack is to detach yourself. Now, that's going to come up later because another character who's presented as a good character is going to be skeptical of all asceticism. So it's unclear whether we're supposed to take her at face value, or not.
Yeah, that's part of like where I'm a little lost in the philosophical dialogue, because it's like, well, Shere Khan is definitely impressed by her, but there's also that sort of like, well, how much of what she's saying is, what we're meant to follow or not? I don't know. It's hard to say.
If this is a novel, it's a novel like Moby Dick or something, where there's all these different genres just kind of tossed together, and the story careens, I guess is the word I'm looking for, from one to another without much warning. This is not the only philosophical discourse that's going to be dropped into the middle of this novel.
this one I feel like is a little easier to follow than the next one that's
Well, it
going to be
helps that
dropped
it's
in
just
there.
one person.
Yeah, that does help. So the other point that she made in here that I thought that was really interesting, just from a I don't know, I found it really fascinating. So she tells several stories about this Umar Ibn al-Khattab, and he's this incredible, incredibly good and pious king and ruler. And then there's a moment where she says that after he died, his son had a vision of him and gets to ask him how he's doing. And he replies, "Had it not been for the mercy of God, your father would certainly have perished." So, even within this system of acting piously and detaching yourself, there's still this undergirding idea that it's really, no matter how good you are, it's God's mercy in the end that actually does the saving, I guess,
Which has been a
which
pretty
I just thought was really
standard
interesting.
theme throughout the 1001 Nights. That comes up a lot.
Oh, but then there's a lot of fatalism also, like I
Sure.
would say, yeah, it's very interesting that contrast between the mercy of God and the fatalism that's all over the place.
So I'm actually less interested in the discourse than in this description of Shar Khan's love for her. It says a lot in a little. When Shar Khan, this is Night 59, page 366 in our edition, 366. When Shar Khan saw her, he felt the attraction of blood to blood, although she had been separated from him when she was little, since when he had never seen her. This was because when he had heard that he had a brother, Da'a-Makan, as well as a sister, Nuzhat al-Zaman, he had hated them both as rivals for the kingdom, and because of this, he knew very little about him, about them, excuse me. So he's about to get into a bad situation, which is that he impregnates his sister. And when I first read this, I wasn't sure we were supposed to think of it as a bad thing, but it does make it clear in the next section that this is a catastrophe. But the reason he does that is because he has felt this toxic emotion toward her to begin with. And so when he meets her, he feels this natural familial affection for her. But because he doesn't know who mm-hmm. she is, because he hates her irrationally, I mean, she can't inherit the empire. Why does he hate her? You can understand, mm-hmm. you can understand him being jealous of his little brother, but like Nushat has no power in this empire. But anyway, because he has poisoned his soul against her, he mistakes what should be a familial affection for an erotic affection. And that is very interesting to me.
Yeah, that is pretty fascinating, especially when you say it that way. Because I was thinking there is another moment, or like, there's, I don't know if you remember, there's the story of these, I think they're two brothers, and they both have a child on the same night, and one's a boy and one's a girl, and so they're fated to like get married, right? But then the brothers cousins. Have a falling out.
Nur-ed-Din and
oh yeah, they're cousins.
They're brothers, but the two.
Right, yeah, but the children are cousins.
That's right. They're not half siblings.
Right. Yes. Yeah, yeah. So yeah. So it's a lot more acceptable, a lot less incestuous to marry a cousin.
Yeah, and I have I guess that was acceptable in this society. In Western Europe, you could not marry your cousin. You needed a special dispensation from the Pope to marry your cousin. Or even like your second, right. That's second or third cousin.
Yeah, there's a book about that, about it's called Weird. Have you heard of this?
I haven't.
Weird stands for, I'm not going to remember what it stands for, but weird stands for something Western, something, something, something. But like the thesis of it, which I have not read it either, I'm just aware of it, is that is part of what has created our particular Western civilization, is that the Christian church put that into place, that you can't marry your cousins, and why... why we're less clannish, I guess, than other parts of the world or something like that. Anyway, I'm probably botching that whole thing because I'm aware of it, but it's an interesting idea. Anyway, what I was going to say was when those two cousins, because I can't remember their whole story, but like they get separated and then like, but when they see each other again, that they, it uses a similar sort of line. Like there's an attraction of familial attraction there, but in that case, it's not, you know, frowned upon. Like they're fated to be together, so it's a good thing. But that's more where I was thinking about it than what you said, where it's this like disordered familial. Like he's you're meant to feel a familial love, but because he doesn't recognize her or know her, it's like this disordered familial love, which I think is much more interesting than the way I was thinking about it.
And you can kind of see the line of dominoes here too. If Umar had not done what he did to Abraza, Sharkan might be married to her now. Now, I mean, these kings have a harem, so it would not necessarily mean that he would not sleep with Nujat, but he might not have fallen quite as in love with her if he had this other woman he was in love with. I don't know. But then also, if Nujat would just reveal her real name, he would know immediately who she was. And she doesn't really have a reason
right.
not to reveal her name yet. And she's going to do it in the next section. And that's what's going to cause the kind of realization that is going to threaten to destroy this family. Although it ends up not being that big of a deal, at least not yet.
No, and actually, I think it's great that you brought it up here, because we do see, I guess in our modern way of talking about, we talk about character growth or something, you know, but like Sharkan like actually goes from this almost irrational jealousy to, you know, very willingly being second in the kingdom, which is a major change from the beginning of the story.
Yeah. Yeah. Once he meets,
and I wonder how,
once he meets Daw, they're friends. They're like, they love each other.
Yeah. And so I wonder how much of that is because of, you know, this interaction that he's having right now, like that kind of resets his, you know, yeah, the way you talked about it. Like, I wonder if he recognizes in some way, like the way that his familial love has been disordered, and he sets about fixing it. You know, it's not clear. We don't get a lot of interiority in these characters, but it is interesting that there is that big change.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't know what else you would point to other than this moment.
So. He's brought low.
Yeah.
Accidental incest is another theme that shows up in a lot of ancient literature as well. Most famously, Oedipus, right?
Yeah.
There too, there's this sense that Oedipus brings it on himself. Like, he doesn't know that he's about to kill his father, but he kills his father because he's kind of a hothead. And just like Sharkan ends up marrying his half sister because he's been given over to jealousy. So you have that, what the Greeks would call a hamartia, tragic flaw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you definitely see that. Because, like you said, the dominoes are falling, right? Like, he had no reason. Like, even when his father sent him to Damascus, he asked to go because he was like, listen, the more time I see you spending with my siblings, the more I get angry about it, and I'm going to kill them. So you should send me away so I won't kill them. But it's not a great solution to the problem, you know? Like, probably, and his dad, like, he doesn't really try to talk him about it, but out of it, but he does mention to him, he's like, you're still the heir to my kingdom. Like, I can send you to Damascus, but like, you don't have anything to worry about here. Like, there is a sense in which he could have resolved it in a different way than running away. And because he ran away, now he has no idea who his own sister is, right? He's never really seen her. So
yeah, that's right. That he's alienated himself from his family.
Yeah.
All right, let's go on to the next section, 68 to 79. So when the twins ran away, Umar was away from Baghdad on a hunting expedition. And when he gets back, he discovers that they're gone. Now, that itself might not be the worst discovery in the world because he knows where they've gone. He knows they've gone on a pilgrimage to Mecca, but they don't come back when he expects them to. And so he ends up writing a letter to Sharkan asking him to look for news wherever he could. Nuzhat gives birth to a daughter. And when she does, she gives the daughter the jewel that her father had given her. And when Sharkan sees it, he's furious. He recognizes the jewel because there's these three jewels that are all the same. And at first he assumes that she has stolen it from his sister. But then she tells him her real name, and Sharkan realizes to his horror what he's done. This is the big realization. He and Nuzhat decide to pretend that her husband is his chief chamberlain, and that baby, the product of their incest, is actually the chamberlain's baby. And this does not really pay off in the section we've read. So I'm interested to see if it comes back in the second half of the novel. Meanwhile, a pious old woman from Byzantium has arrived in Baghdad, and she's got these five educated virgins, and Umar wants to buy them because he's so impressed with their wisdom. And this is the second, it's really like the second through the sixth discourses, because each one of these, oh, you know, actually, I'm sorry, that's in the next section. So anyway, all we know is these five educated virgins, and he wants to buy them. But the woman says she'll only sell them for the tribute of Damascus. So this is like all the tax money that's been collected in Damascus. And so Umar asks Sharkan to send him that money along with this girl who has so impressed Sharkan, because he thinks he can pit this girl against the five Byzantine women, and it's going to be very impressive. As the caravan is leaving Damascus, Daw al-Makan happens to be watching it. There's your kind of fairy tale coincidence. And when he finds out that the caravan is going to his father, he and the furnace man go alongside it. And one night, the caravan is resting, and Daw recites all this sad poetry about the loss of his sister. This is what you were referencing at the beginning of the episode. She hears his voice and recognizes it, and the two are reunited. As they're about to enter Baghdad, they find out that King Umar has been poisoned and is dead. Umar's vizier had decided that Sharkan was going to be the next king, but then he meets Daw, and he's so impressed with him that he goes to the board of regents, basically, and puts Daw on the throne instead. And then they tell the story of what happened to Umar, and this section ends with the old woman and her five virgins telling Umar their various philosophical ideas. And ChatGPT and its non-wisdom has actually cut that discourse off. So it begins here, but it actually, the bulk of it is in the next section, as is the actual story of what happened to Umar.
Yeah. So so we know at this point, I don't know if you mentioned it in your summaries, you may have and I just missed it, but we know at this point that this old woman ascetic is not really an ascetic, that
right.
he is working for King Hubar, is that his name?
Oh, and, gosh, I wrote it down. Oh, Abrazah's father. Hardu.
Hardu, yeah, sorry. And is
he's the king working, of, he's the king this of is a, Rum, R-U-M, which is an area of Turkey.
Yeah, but this is a long con because he wanted to go get immediate revenge when he finds his daughter dead in the desert. Like this is the way these people treat my daughter, you know. And she says, no, I've got a plan. And so she has been educating these girls for years in order to infiltrate his court. And so when she shows up as this ascetic, we know, I mean, I guess at this point, we haven't learned that much about her. We've only met her at the convent. So I
guess right. It's the same woman.
Being at the convent, she could have, she could have been an ascetic of some sort, but,
no, she's a fraud. So, yeah. There's an amazing description of her in a later section that I'll read. I'm sure, she is a fraud in every way. She's pretending to be Muslim, but she's not even really a Christian. So she's the great villain of at least the first half of this novel. Really kind of irredeemably evil in a hilarious way. You would call her a mustache twirler if she were a man, but she doesn't have a mustache. Of course, she will dress up as a man later. So maybe then we can call her a mustache twirling villain.
That's right. Yeah. So the other part in this section, I loved the poetry reciting and
I knew you would.
The twins reunite. But it's so funny also. It's just a really funny setup because the she keeps sending her eunuch out to find this person who's, you know, the only person reciting. Everyone else is asleep. They've been traveling across the desert, you know, in a caravan. They're exhausted. They're trying to sleep. And he's just so overwhelmed with his emotions. He must keep reciting. And the furnace man is afraid for their lives. He thinks the eunuch's coming out to not to reward him because reuniting him with his sister, but to kill him for, you know, distressing this high-ranking official that they're traveling with. And so it was very, very funny, but it's also one of those things that makes you just question everything you're reading, because I could see the humor in that part, but then I'm wondering is there humor that I'm missing in other parts, you know, but it's very funny.
Yeah, there are eruptions of humor throughout this. But then also there's stuff you're supposed to take just deadly seriously. I really think you're supposed to see it as a deep tragedy that Sharkhan has impregnated his half sister.
Yeah, I feel that way too. It's just hard to tell as a reader, you know. That's the way I took it for sure. I guess maybe in the times when it's not hard to tell is one of those things where it's like, oh yeah, this is, you know, story is story, people are people, you know, and it's, you do laugh at the same points and feel the tragedy at the same points that earlier readers potentially would have felt it.
Well, humor is one of those things that does not translate very well across time and space. So it might be that there's lots of other funny stuff that we're just not catching. I'm sure this is one of the difficulties of being the translator of this sort of text. How do you make humor that would have been obvious to people, you know, 700 years ago? How do you make it obvious to readers today who are in a totally different culture as well? Mm-hmm. It's not just time, it's space.
Yeah, exactly. So.
But I figure in a novel, in a story this long, you're going to have some humor, right?
Yeah. Well, and as you said, this novel is just packed with anything you can throw in it. It's in there. So.
Do you think Scheherazade is making the story up as she goes along, or do you think she actually knows all of these stories? This just occurred to me.
It seems. Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know. for the complication of some of these stories, it would seem like she has to know them.
Right.
And can't just be making them up as she goes along, right?
Yeah, yeah. A lot of the fairy tales we read, a lot of the Grimms have this, you can kind of feel people just making it up, and that's why characters get dropped and scenes don't pay off. But this is so crafted. It's so composed compared to that.
Yeah. But I don't know, like, within, because, so I don't know. I haven't done extensive research on like how the Arabian Nights came about. I know that it is a curated collection of some sort, right? It's not, you know, she did, it's not like just, she actually said all these things and then later a scribe wrote them down, right? The framing story is not true in that sense, you know? So, but as far as like, as a hearer or reader of the story, are you supposed to have the idea that she's making these up as she goes along? That is an interesting question. I don't know. Maybe you are supposed to think that. Maybe that adds to some of the mystery of it. That she spends her days, you know, composing these tales that are going to help her, you know, survive the night.
You wonder when she and the king sleep. Because every night it says it doesn't say that the king, I don't remember the king's name, it doesn't say that he falls asleep, it says that morning breaks.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, she tells these stories all night, so yeah.
All
I don't know.
All right, well, section 80 to 86, we get these discourses by the five women. He's very impressed by their education. He's very impressed by the old woman's piety. And again, he wants to buy the five women. But this time the old woman tells him the only way she's going to sell them is that he has to fast for an entire month. And again, this is a trick. She's the villain of this piece. But, you know, who's gonna suspect somebody who's so pious that they're willing to fast for an entire month? So she gives him some instructions about what to do, and she goes on her way. She comes back every 10 days or so and gives him something else that he's supposed to use to break his fast at the end of the time period. And she also takes with her Sophia, the concubine who is the mother of Al-Makan. Yeah, Al-Makan, that's right. And Nujat. So he tells her to take Sophia with her because he wants to have Sophia blessed, because that will bring the children back safely. But of course, this has been part of her plan. She wants to take Sophia back to her father, Emperor Afridun. And so after his month of fasting is up, he drinks this liquid she gives him, which turns out to be poison, and that's how he dies. And his handlers find this note in his room from the old woman, who turns out to be this evil woman named Dat al-Dawahi. And she is working for Afridun, the Byzantine emperor. And in this note, it says that he's going to be attacking Baghdad soon in revenge for his daughter being treated like a slave. And that's the end of night 86.
Yeah. So in this discourse, I don't know how much we want to go over in this discourse, but there was one particular one on night 84 that just was like awesome. And it stinks because it's the evil villain who says it, you know? And so like, it's like, oh man, what are you supposed to make of this? But she says that this is on page 413 in our version, that Abu Hanifa was told that he had been appointed a qadi or a quadi, a judge basically, by Abu Jafar al-Mansur, with an allowance of 10,000 dirhams, and he did not approve of this. On the day when the money was supposed to come to him, he performed the morning prayer and then wrapped himself in his robe and said nothing. The caliph's messenger arrived with the money, but when he came in and spoke to Abu Hanifa, Abu Hanifa made no reply. "This money is legally yours," said the messenger. "I know that," replied Abu Hanifa, "but I do not want love of tyrants to enter my heart." "Can you not associate with them?" asked the man, "and yet keep yourself from loving them?" Can I be sure that if I go into the sea, my clothes will not get wet? Abu Hanifa replied.
Yeah, that's a great line.
That could be written today.
That's right. You know? And in fact, some people today should hear that line.
Yeah. Oh man, that one was like, wow. Just what we were talking about in the last section. Talk about talking across space and time, like. Man, that was a. It's like, wow, that's really good.
That might be a better line than "if you lie down with dogs, you wake up with fleas."
Yeah.
But yeah, I like that. Yeah, can you walk into the sea and expect your clothes not to get wet? That corruption. If you associate with corrupt people, you will eventually yourself become corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Although it didn't happen that way for Jesus, did it?
That's true. Yeah. He kind of does the reverse thing. He makes the unclean clean.
I feel like you kind of have to respect Dot al-Dawahi for what she's done here. Like, how long she had to plan out this plan and how skillfully she executes it. The fact that she tricks him into giving her Sophia. Like, this is a genius, even if she's an evil genius.
Yeah, she is definitely. Yeah, you called her a mustache twirler earlier, which I understand what you mean by it. But a lot of those mustache twirlers are kind of, you know, they're played for laughs. They're a little goofy. You know, I'm thinking of like Barnaby in Babes in Toyland, like that kind of mustache twirler. You know, but yeah, she's really. I mean, she is evil to the core, but also extremely good at her job. He's an extremely competent evil person.
All right. Well, should we start the crusade?
Let's start it.
87 and 93, we get the Holy War. The crusades, well, nobody knows when this particular story was written, but by the time the 1001 Nights were actually compiled, the famous crusades were all over, just for the record. So the crusade begins, and Daw writes a letter to his half-brother Sharkhan, calling on him to help him take on this enormous Byzantine army. He cannot do it alone. And so they end up invading Byzantium before Byzantium can invade them. And there's a whole bunch of battles. I won't claim that I'm going to go over every single one of them. But the Muslims win the first battle. And the Christians, this is my favorite part, the Christians decide to come back for round two with a secret weapon, incense. And the incense is made from the excrement of the Patriarch of Constantinople. This is another point at which the Muslims have misunderstood exactly what the Christians are up to. But so they've got incense that's made from the excrement of this patriarch, and they spread it all over the face of a great Christian warrior named Luka ibn Shamlut, or the Sword of the Messiah, who challenges Sharkhan to one-on-one combat. And Sharkhan, it is a pretty anticlimactic battle, because Sharkhan throws a javelin right through the middle of his face, where I believe they have made a cross with the patriarch's excrement. And I think he hits it right in the middle of the cross.
Mm-hmm.
Then the two armies meet, and the Muslims pretend to retreat so that the Christians will think they've been defeated. And the Christians send word to King Harub that they've won. Because they think the Muslims have run away. But then the Muslims turn back to the battle and just utterly destroy the Christians. And Constantinople is in the middle of rejoicing over the victory that they've imagined they've won when the messenger arrives and tells them the horrible truth. Then Dot al-Dawahi comes to Emperor Afridun, and she offers to help. She makes a potion, and she dresses up as a holy man and heads for the Baghdad army, where she's going to sow confusion in their ranks. There you have another kind of standard fairy tale trope. You get the evil queen dressing up as something she's not. It's interesting, though, because she dresses up as a man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess the idea is that she's, you know, she's so old that she's become kind of androgynous, I guess, you know? Like, you can't really tell anymore if she's a woman or a man, but yeah. It's an interesting disguise that she uses.
And here is the description of her from night 93, right at the end of this section. This is amazing. This damned woman was a sorceress, skilled in magic and in lies, unchaste, wily, debauched, and treacherous, with foul breath, red eyelids, sallow cheeks, and a dark face, bleary eyes, and a body covered with scabs. Her hair was gray. She was hunchback. Her complexion was pallid, and her nose streamed with mucus. She had, however, read Islamic text and had traveled to the Haram of Mecca, all of this in order to study religions and to become acquainted with the verses of the Quran. For 2 years, she had claimed to follow Judaism in Jerusalem in order to possess herself of all the wiles of men and jinn. She was a disaster and an affliction, with no sound faith and no adherence to any religion. It was because of his virgin slave girls that she spent most of the time with her son, Hardub, king of Rum, for she was a passionate lesbian, and if deprived of her pleasure for long, she would wilt away. If any slave girl pleased her, she would teach her this art, crush saffron over her, and fall into a lengthy faint on top of her as a result of the pleasure she received. Those who obeyed her she treated well and commended to her son, but schemed to destroy any who did not. So she is truly evil in every way that a 14th century Muslim could think someone was evil. You can't even say, oh, well, at least she's a pious Christian, because she's not that either. So a Christian reading this would also hate her just because she's evil in so many ways and disgusting, right? It's not just that she's corrupt in terms of her character. Her body is disgusting too.
Yeah. She's just all around gross. Very gross. This is the part. So going back to that kind of, is this being made up as it goes along? This was one part where I felt like it was not quite to the level of like characters dropping out and things like that, but like where Dat al-Dawahi or Dawi is now versus when we first met her, as like she was kind of I forget what the head mistress or whatever at a convent is, you know, but she was kind of like, you know, in the initial wrestling match at the convent, she was supposed to be, you know, just kind of the lead lady there. It's very, very, it's a very, very different turn. It's like, did the author have this in mind at the beginning?
Well, she is a master of disguise, you know, and she's got this witchcraft. So it might be that she is able to make herself less disgusting when she needs to. And also, given that she's a, quote, passionate lesbian, you can see why she would want to hang out at the convent.
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm not saying it doesn't make sense. It just was a little jarring. It was like, wow, it feels like a different character than the character that we just met, or that we first met when we first met her. Falling on her, you know, tailbone and farting as she did so. This is quite different, you know.
Also, I just realized she must be Abraza's grandmother.
She's her grandmother.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's her grandmother.
So they're wrestling naked with her granddaughter.
Yeah.
Kind of weird.
Yeah.
Kind of upsetting. But again, everything weird this woman does is disgusting. So
yeah, she's upsetting.
She's a great villain.
Yeah. Yeah. The strange aside in this, I mean, you kind of mentioned it, but the strange aside on like where Christian incense comes from is like, yeah, I didn't know how to take it. Like, is it just supposed to be funny? Is it really just misunderstanding of like what Christians are doing? Is it both? Is it a purposeful misunderstanding? Is it like a treating the other as something really disgusting and weird and something to be, you know, not to be part of? It was hard to tell.
Yeah, it's hard to tell whether it's meant.
It still came across as a little funny, but also extremely sacrilegious at the same time.
Well, and they seem to be
a little bad about making it funny.
They seem to be confusing incense and anointing oil, right? Because you burn incense, they wouldn't spread it all over the face of this warrior.
Yeah, it's a little weird. It's very, very strange.
Yeah. Sharkhan throwing the javelin right
through
the
right, this
face is very, they're lining up for this one-on-one fight. It's very Indiana Jones. the scene, yeah. The scene where the guy's got the big sword and he just shoots him.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it was another kind of, I mean, we just meet this character, so it's not as, you know, shocking as the death of the princess earlier, but it was kind of like, there's this like build up. And then boom, he's gone. He's out of the picture. So all the fights are kind of interesting. Oh, so there's in this one, and then there's another battle tactic later that seemed to be drawing out of the Old Testament, you know, because there's that famous battle in, I guess it's in Joshua, I think, that this one is referencing, where, you know, Joshua sends the troops to be behind to ambush, which is the same kind of idea that happens here, you know, like we'll fake a retreat. And then when they chase us, then the ambushing group will come out, and so that happens here.
Also,
and then in the next section, I think we get one that's
also a standard battle tactic of the Mongols.
Oh, okay. So maybe they're drawing off of that.
It could be either one. I mean, obviously Joshua is a holy book for Muslims as well.
Yeah,
but the Mongols did conquer a lot of this area in the 13th and 14th century.
The descriptions of the battles are, I know we don't have to go over them all, but they are heads are rolling like everywhere. Like it continues to be very poetic language. They're pretty fun to read. Yeah. Not too dissimilar from like, the Iliad or something, you know,
right,
where there's a lot of poetic descriptions of the battles and what's going on. It's not too dissimilar from something like that.
Or from Christian descriptions of the Crusades. I'm trying to remember the guy, William of Tyre, I think. He has a description of the capture of Jerusalem at the end of the First Crusade. And it describes the blood just soaking through the temple in Jerusalem. This is clearly drawing on some sort of cultural memory of the Crusades, the holy war here between Muslims and Christians. And again, this is something new in the 1001 Nights. We haven't seen something like a holy war before. There's been a kind of maybe confusion, but a tentative respect between Christians and Muslims, which makes sense because it comes, you know, so much of this draws on the Abbasid Caliphate, which was much more tolerant than most medieval societies. All right, let's look at 94 to 100. We're heading toward the end here. Here, Dot al-Dawahi tricks Sharkhan and Daw al-Markhan into going into a monastery, and they are ambushed by 10,000 Christian horsemen, and she disappears in the ensuing battle. And they still don't know who she is. They consider it bad luck that they've lost this holy man. She comes back holding the head of a Christian warrior. She says she killed him herself, but she didn't. A Turk had killed him, and she just cut the head off the body. But this convinces them that she's on their side, and they're overjoyed to see her. And she leads Sharkhan and his vizier, Dandan, away and has them captured, although they still don't know that she's the one behind it. The Christian army tells the Muslims that they will kill Daw al-Markhan and Dandan if they don't surrender. And if they do surrender, they will allow them to leave their territory peacefully. And Sharkhan is very, very distressed by all of this, but he does not surrender. Instead, he leads his army into battle and kills hundreds of Christians, although the Muslims also lose a lot of men. And at the end of the day, the Muslims seem to be on their last legs. They have 25 soldiers left, and they hide in a cave. And the next day, Sharkhan tells him, you can't attack the Christians directly. All you can do is defend the cave. And then the Christians set fire to the cave and the Muslims surrender. The Christian leaders refuse to kill them unless they can do it in the presence of Emperor Afridun. So they're going to take them back to Constantinople. But the Christians get so drunk that night that Sharkhan and his companions are able to sneak away. And Sharkhan actually makes a kind of Samson move. He gets so mad that he just breaks through the ropes that are tying him. And then he takes a key away from a drunk guard, sets Daw and Dandan and the other Muslims free, and they steal some horses and run away while the Christians sleep off their bender. And that's the end of night 100.
Yeah, Well, at the end of that, this is the other battle that I was mentioning that's kind of Old Testament style. Like they do kind of the Gideon thing. Like they go up on top of the mountain and they yell, and knowing that the Christians are in no state to fight, and then the Christians get up and fight each other, you know? And kill even more of themselves off while the Muslims get away.
Right. And yeah, and here you have it's not just that the Christians are stupid, they're also impious. This idea that they're going to get loaded to celebrate their victory before they've really won the victory, you know? Before they've accomplished their final end. The Christians are prone to premature celebration in this novel.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in this particular story. There's a lot of that. It's fun that Al Dawai she gets her message to the emperor by sending it via pigeon. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I guess they I didn't realize they were doing messenger pigeons that far back.
Yeah. So that's kind of fun. But yeah, not a lot else to say in this section. They're kind of, it's she's continuing to fool them, and but in this part I feel like she's starting to get a little worse at her job. Like they still the cracks are beginning to show through. This is when Don Don begins to be suspicious about her because he does not trust people who are this religiously I guess like mystics like is what he doesn't really
We're
trust.
kind of back to that moderation idea that even asceticism in moderation, in out of moderation, is a bad thing. And Don Don is the only one who recognizes that.
And she does a lot of time like kind of setting up plans that then don't fully work. So she gets she gets Don Don and Dao al-Makan caught, like that works, but then even with only 25 soldiers versus 10,000 or however many Christians left, like they still win. So it's not that her plans are bad, they're just kind of convoluted, and she has many opportunities when she could just kill them, but she doesn't. She keeps relying on the army to do it, and the army is very incompetent. So there's a little bit, maybe at this point she's getting a little mustache twirly with her extremely convoluted plans. Like she's already infiltrated their ranks. Like she could if she but then of course she can't win, she's the villain, but you know
Well,
what
she pulls off a pretty big one in the next section, to be fair.
I mean. She does. It's true. Yes, that's true. To be fair.
So let's look at that. The Muslim army is besieging Constantinople. Always a mistake. Constantinople falls twice in human history. Although, to be fair, one time it was to the Muslims. So the Muslim army is besieging Constantinople, and Dat al-Dawahi rushes to the city. She's still dressed as a holy man, and she tells the Muslims that she's run into a Christian army and they need to send 20,000 men to intercept them. She's trying to relieve the city from the siege. So she returns a few days later and tells them the Christians are defeating the army that's been sent, and the rest of the Muslims need to go too. And here, Don Don doesn't trust her, and he points out that nothing has gone right for them since they met her. But Sharkhan and Daa nevertheless go to meet the other battalion of their army. Meanwhile, Dat al-Dawahi has sent a letter to Emperor Afridun telling him to go out against the Muslims. And they surround the Muslim army, and they very nearly defeat them. But at this moment, Sharkhan appears with the rest of the Muslim army. And a long battle ensues during which Sharkhan is injured and passes out. And Daa quite reasonably thinks he's dead, so he sends his riders out to bring him back. And the fight goes on. The fight goes on, could be said, almost every 2 minutes of this section. There's just so many battles. But Daa leaves the fight to return to his half brother. Dat al-Dawi arrives. She's still dressed as a holy man, and Daa allows her to treat his half brother. And Sharkhan wakes up the next morning. And here again, you wonder, why does she not just kill him when she's taking care of him? It would have been super easy. But anyway, the battle continues. The next day, it is King Harub who is leading the charge against Da'al Makan, and he kills the king and chops his head off. The Muslims win the battle, and Da and Sharkan attribute their victory to the holy man. But in the middle of the night, Dawahi murders Sharkan, and Dandan realizes that she has been on the Christian side the whole time. She escapes, but she writes a letter telling the story of what she's done, and she also announces that she's going to kill Da'awa Makan and every other Muslim leader. But nevertheless, the Muslims continue the siege. At this point, Da'awa Makan receives a letter from Baghdad announcing that his wife has given birth to a son and that Nuzhat al-Zaman, his sister, is praying for the Muslims during the siege. And so this brings him out of his grief over Sharkan, and he has the Quran recited for Sharkan, and then asks Dandan to tell him some stories of kings and lovers that will make him feel better. And that's where we're going to pick up the story next month, because this is finally when we get one of the nested stories that the 1001 Nights are so famous for. I mean, we've gone, 175 pages without a nested story? It's got to be the longest stretch in the 1001 Nights.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we get... We do have a lot of different subplots just because the story is so long, you know, and various plans and, Dot al-Dawi comes up with several different versions and stories of where she's come from and, you know, what she's up to, particularly this one is she's a holy man, about how she spent 15 years in the monastery. So you do have little glimpses of sub stories, but they're definitely, it's not the nested story that we're so used to.
And you could call the discourses from Nuzhat and the five slave girls, you could call those nested stories, even though they're not narrative.
Right. Yeah. They're nested in the sense of I heard about this king and, this happened to him and this happened to him. But I mean, they're so short that they're not really nested.
Yeah. Our book, not in the way that doesn't treat them as separate stories.
Right. Yeah.
Although, you know what? If I, we devised this to go right up to the next nested story. I think if I had read this before we set up the, reading, I probably would not have gone that far. I probably would have stopped it. But live and learn.
Yeah. And that's okay. I mean, we're, that's exactly what we're doing. We're learning as we go along. So, it's all fun.
So for next month, we're going to finish King Umar ibn al-Numan, go all the way to night for 145. So it's still, golly, it's still 125 pages, but it is at least shorter than this month. I think this month is probably going to be our longest month of reading, the month we just did.
Yeah. Yeah. And this next one, I think there's a nested story within that nested story, then a third nested story, and then... You know, and then the end of this story, hopefully. I am curious about the end of how this story is going.
Yeah, where else it's gonna go. I mean, well, I imagine we're gonna get several more generations.
Yeah, that's another thing that's kind of fun about this story. So from the emperor all the way down to this new baby that has just been born, who is still related to the emperor, because you've got the emperor, you've got Sophia, you've got our main character that I'm blanking on his name right now, Da'al Makan, and then his new son. So you've got, several generations, which is pretty fun.
But remember also that we have two more children in that generation that we have lost track of, who I assume are going to come back. Abrazah's son and, and Nuzhat's incestuous daughter. So it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah.
To see if they come back in the second half of this novel.
Yeah. Well, Nuzhat's incestuous daughter, which is, I'm not going to be able to pronounce her name correctly because it starts with a Q, Kudia Fa'akana, has been promised already to Kanama Kana, the new son that was just born. Because before Sharkan died, he and his brother had made that deal that if they're, if it was a son that was born, that they would be betrothed to be married. So we might solve a marriage in our future here too. Exciting. And maybe even another generation after that.
Exciting stuff.
For sure. All right. Well, our press liaison is Kristen Filipic, and we're on the old interwebs at christianhumanist.org. You can help us continue this conversation by reaching out to us at beforetheywerelive@gmail.com. Also, please check out Michael's weekly podcast, A Symposium, A Popular Song. That's over at Front Porch Republic. We also want to encourage you to set your podcast player's dials to the Christian Humanist Radio Network. There's a bunch of old shows over there, and some occasional new shows like ours. Anyway, we know there's a great number of podcasts out there you could be spending your time on, so thanks for spending the time with us. So for Michael Farmer, I'm Joshua Altman-Schofer, reminding you that what is not to happen will never happen by a trick, and that which is to happen will take place, and what is fated comes at its own time, although the fool will always be deceived.